development comes on a day that saw several protests in support of pro-Palestine activists currently held in British prisons.
Members of Derry City Strabane District Council, and our council does have a history of solidarity and support for the Palestinian cause, and that was extended to support the hunger strikers and express solidarity. We listened to the families, and what they were saying is very, very similar to what Irish people faced at the same enemy, the British imperialism, with the hunger strikes in 80 and 81. And not just that very system that demonizes and criminalizes anybody who dares, you know, oppose it.
It's no surprise to us that the British state, with all its Zionist interests, with all its colonial interests, with all the violence that it spreads around the world, continues to ignore us. The lives of the hunger strikers, just like the lives of the Palestinian people, are worth nothing compared to the profit of companies like Elbit Systems. So we make our own justice. That's why we're here today with our comrades from Ireland. That's why we continue to fight on the streets with the people to do things in our own way.
I think it's appalling. You know, there's a genocide going on. The ceasefire is only in name. Israel's killed maybe 400 people since the so-called ceasefire happened. I completely support the hunger strikers. I think it's amazing what they're doing. I completely support the people in prison. I support Palestine Action, taking action against the weapons companies that send munitions off to Gaza and the West Bank to murder people.
Iran strongly condemned the continuation of Israel's genocide in Gaza through the regime's incessant bombardment and blockade of humanitarian aid. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said that the international community, taught by the UN, United Nations, that is responsible for taking immediate and effective measures to stop Israel's crimes and hold perpetrators to account. He categorically condemned Israel's blatant violations of international humanitarian law and the regime's war crimes and crimes against humanity, stressing the need to end its impunity. Baghaei said that U.S. and other countries providing Israel with arms and political support are complicit in the regime's crimes in occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. And he added that despite its ceasefire agreements with Gaza and Lebanon, Israel continues to commit savage crimes against both nations due to Washington's unbridled support and inaction of ceasefire guarantors. Baghaei called for serious measures to confront Israel's threats to regional and international peace and security. Iran has called for next Secretary General of the United Nations to be selected through a transparent process, voicing readiness to engage in meaningful discussions throughout the process. Iran's permanent UN ambassador, Amir Said Iravani, made the comment while addressing a Security Council session held to discuss the qualities of the future of the UN chief. He said a candidate who has deliberately failed to uphold the UN charter or to condemn unlawful military attacks against peaceful nuclear facilities, despite responsibilities of the organ that he leads, could not be trusted as a faithful guardian of the UN charter. Iravani added that such a person will not be able to fulfill his duties independently, impartially, and without political bias or fear of powerful states as required under the charter. Iran's ambassador also declared Tehran's willingness to work with the next Secretary General to advance peace, justice, and purposes and principles of the UN Charter. Meanwhile, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi is on a two-leg official visit to Belarus and Russia. In Minsk, he met with senior officials and signed several agreements aimed at deepening bilateral cooperation. Mariam Azarchir reports.
What good can ever come from American sanctions? Part of the answer now unfolding during Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi's three-day official visit to Belarus and Russia, a trip that underscores growing ties among countries facing similar pressure. The dynamic on display in Minsk, where Araghchi held high-level talks with senior Belarusian officials. The two sides signed agreements aimed at expanding cooperation and further strengthening already close ties. Officials from both countries say mounting external pressure has accelerated coordination across political and economic fronts.
On political issues, our positions in international organizations and various forums are very close to one another. Resisting unilateralism and coercive measures, as well as policies of force and domination, has been one of our shared efforts. Together with a number of other countries that share this stance against American unilateralism, we have formed the Friends of the Charter Group at the UN. We have decided to increase consultations within the framework of this group and likewise our cooperation within BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the Eurasian Union will be further expanded.
Together we have explored and developed very interesting frameworks for a political approach. Ahead of us are new decisions and corresponding projects. We are confident that as a result of today's agenda review, we will be able to reach deeper and more substantive conclusions and strengthen international relations and ties between peoples.
Abbas Araghchi expressed gratitude that Belarus had demonstrated solidarity with Iran during the 12-day U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country. However, the talks were not limited to political stances and international affairs.
Our economic cooperation is extensive and spans across multiple sectors. However, it's insufficient, and both sides are committed to expanding collaboration in trade, investment, and joint production. For example, Iran is a major customer of Belarus's potash, and it was decided today to further facilitate this cooperation.
As part of his visit, Araghchi paid homage to the Belarusian victims of World War II at Minsk Victory Square, a gesture highlighting shared experiences of hardship, now echoed in what both countries describe as an ongoing economic war driven by sanctions.
These meetings are seen as yet another step in strengthening friendly ties, with Iran's top diplomat pushing forward cooperation in various political, economic, and regional fronts. Mariam Azarchar, Minsk.
Now, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia supports Iran's right to have peaceful nuclear energy. In an interview with the IRIB, Lavrov referred to a Bushehr nuclear power plant that's being constructed in southwestern Iran as an example of cooperation between the two. He added that both Moscow and Tehran are determined to expand relations. Lavrov also slammed the European Troika for reinstating sanctions against Tehran, calling it a disgrace of diplomacy. Lavrov noted there is no solid document showing Iran has violated obligations under the rules of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And regarding the 12-day imposed war back in June, the Russian foreign minister said that Moscow has condemned the illegitimate attacks launched by Israel and the U.S. against Iran. Now we turn over to the Russia-Ukraine war with two sides, a trail of fresh fire across multiple areas, including the Black Sea region. Ukrainian officials say in the country's Sumy region, a 62-year-old man was killed in a Russian drone strike. Russian forces also launched hundreds of attacks in Zaporizhia, injuring over a dozen people and damaging homes. Some other areas in Ukraine, including Kherson, saw fresh Russian attacks as well. Meanwhile, Moscow says it's destroyed scores of Ukrainian drones overnight. Amid exchanges of fire, diplomatic efforts continue. Both sides weigh conditions for a settlement to the conflict. Kremlin said Monday that Ukraine must not join the NATO military alliance.
Naturally, the possible Ukraine's membership in NATO is one of the cornerstones and, of course, it is subject to special discussion. And this is the sense of a negotiation process that I repeated once again.
Peskov also said Russia expects an update from Washington following U.S. talks with European countries and Ukraine in Berlin. After a meeting in the German capital, Trump said an agreement to end the war is closer than ever. Moscow argues that Ukraine should give up joining NATO. It also says Kiev must surrender territory for the war to end. European leaders, meanwhile, say any territorial concession can only be decided by Ukraine itself and that firm security guarantees are needed. In the UK, the unemployment rate has increased to 5.1%, marking the highest in 4 years. That, according to figures from the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, which shows a jobless rate in 3 months to October. The ONS says the overall picture signals a weakening labor market, reflecting, quote, subdued hiring activity. The numbers also indicate youngsters are bearing the brunt of job cuts as a fall in payroll numbers and increase in unemployment were particularly among younger age groups. U.S. President Donald Trump has sued the British broadcasting corporation, the BBC, over editing parts of a speech that he made around 5 years ago. Trump filed a lawsuit in federal court in Miami. The lawsuit says the BBC maliciously strung together two comments he made in order to show that he had encouraged his supporters to engage in violence during the Capitol Hill attack back in January of 2021. The complaint seeks $5 billion in damages, alleging the British public broadcaster defamed him by his speech edit. The BBC previously admitted editing gave the mistaken impression that Trump made a direct call for violent action, but it said that there is no legal basis to sue. U.S. military says it's launched fresh strikes on alleged drug trafficking vessels in international waters. U.S. Southern Command says three vessels were struck while they were transiting long routes in the East Pacific. It added the attacks killed eight men. Since September, Washington has targeted now at least 26 boats in the Caribbean and East Pacific under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. The attacks come amid escalating tensions with Venezuela over U.S. accusations that it is aiding drug smugglers. President Donald Trump has even threatened a ground invasion of a Latin American country. Crockett says the campaign is actually aimed at toppling the Venezuelan government and seizing the country's natural oil resources. Meanwhile, French protesters have gathered in the capital of Paris to denounce austerity measures and a growing war economy. They argue that public funds are diverted from healthcare and education to militarization and foreign interventions. Demonstrators also criticize France's recent military actions abroad and billions allocated to the defense budget. Students in particular voice concerns over university's partnership with arms companies, saying makes them complicit in genocide. Our correspondent has spoken to some of the participants.
This gathering follows other demonstrations and rallies that we have organized against militarization and war, because, as you must know, in France and throughout the European Union, the economy is doing poorly. But it is being redirected toward war and toward imperialist aggression budgets, whether it is support for Israel, the war in Ukraine, or interventions in Africa. France, just last week, carried out a military intervention in Benin. That is just one example among others. So we have a system that is completely running out of steam and is trying to survive through a war economy and by increasing arms sales, profits, arms dealers, and so on. And of course, young people in particular, but also the country more generally, do not want to sacrifice healthcare budgets, education budgets, and more broadly their standard of living to a war policy and to sending young people to serve as cannon fodder.
So this is a rally against austerity and the war budget. We are here to denounce the Social Security budget, but also to denounce the war budget, which I believe is close to 400 billion euros for imperialist war, for colonial wars in Palestine and everywhere else in the world. I think that when you are a student, you realize this more than other people do. For example, our universities are directly complicit in these genocides. If we take the case of Palestine, I am a student at Sorbonne University, and Sorbonne University has direct partnerships with arms companies.
And staying with France, farmers have blocked roads in southern parts of the country in protest at the government's animal health policy. The protesters were angry with the government's measures aimed at curbing an outbreak of lumpy skin disease among livestock. Measures include culling of entire cattle herds. Police intervened to disperse crowds as veterinary teams arrived to carry out the culling. On Friday, more than 200 cows were slaughtered in a village near the Spanish border after a single case of the disease was detected. Farmers' unions say the wiping out entire herds is unnecessary and ineffective and are calling for nationwide blockades across France to put an end to the madness, as they put it. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Say that love. I possess, I offer you. I want to be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and I am your host, Zainab. Honored to be here with Brother Muhammad Liaquat Abbas as a guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Dear listeners, Brother Muhammad Liaquat Abbas is a research scholar in the Hawza Ilmi of Qom and also possesses a background in the field of psychology. Making him a perfect guest for our program. Well, in this program, we discuss the topics and issues that are important for Islamic upbringing and that can benefit both parents as well as the children. So our answers in this program are based upon the Noble Book of Quran and also the Ahadith from Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family. And we also take help from the narrations of noble imams. Well, to begin with, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that anyone who strives to rectify the people, the society, is among the best of the fortunes. Yes, we are talking about societal management today, societal participation. So, Brother Liaquat, when talking about our children, how do we encourage them to take part in the society?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's world of busy schedule, in today's world of technology, of social media, we see our youths, our kids, not getting much involved in the society or in the Husainiyah or in the masajid, the mosques, and participating in the activities over there.
I
don't deny it completely, of course. There are places, alhamdulillah, where we can see a lot of participation as well. But there comes a place where a person should manage everything, like managing the Husainiyah or managing the Imam Bargah example, or managing the mosque, which is very important. So over here we have a lot of ahadith about management itself. Like we have Imam Ali alayhi salam saying, good management prolongs one's term of leadership. So if a person is taking up the task of arranging a majlis, okay, a congregation for the mourning of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, it should be done in the best manner.
Right.
Yeah. So managing how the majlis is going. And another youth, why I'm taking the name of youth is because we have learned from Imam Ali alayhi salam that when he was about 11 years old or 10 years old,
yeah,
he was given the duty to organize and manage the whole of Dawat al-Zulashira. That is the congregation, the invitation which was invited by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, where he gave invitation towards his nearest of kins,
mm-hmm,
and invited them to the religion of Islam.
Islam, yeah.
So everything like the zibh, that is, mm-hmm, the sacrifice of the goat,
mm-hmm,
for meat,
mm-hmm,
and the cooking of food,
mm-hmm,
and arranging of the drinks, mm-hmm, water, milk, everything was done by Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam,
wow,
Ali al-Islam. Yeah,
in
he was just 10, 11, you see?
Yeah.
At such a young age, he's managing everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because of course, in later stage, we see Amir al-Mu'mineen having a lot of responsibility managing,
right,
the whole ummah. It's,
yeah,
not a small thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this is how it,
the management
it is started.
Starts,
yeah,
from the
exactly,
beginning.
Like,
yeah,
from small things. For us, even this is a big thing.
Right,
but,
yeah.
But
like, because we will never count on an 11-year child and we'll say, like even if they show,
mm-hmm,
kind of interest towards doing,
yeah,
things, and we'll be like, no, no, just go away. We, you
we
won't
will
be
do
able
everything.
To.
You can't do anything.
You can't do anything.
Of course,
right,
there was Prophet to guide Imam Ali. There was
right,
Hazrat Abu Talib, alayhi salatu wasalam,
to
guide his,
yeah,
son. Yeah, there was,
yeah,
that was there. But the very fact that Amir al-Mu'mineen had arranged everything,
mm-hmm,
this is a focus point, I would,
right,
say. Yeah.
And we have a lot to learn from that. We'll take a short break here to reflect on the same, and we'll get back in a while.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, Wa Khaliquna, Wa Rasiquna, Wa Huwa Ala Kulli Shay'in Qadeer.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is the program Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about societal management in kids. How do we teach our children societal management or societal participation? Well, you said that in Islam we have guidances like from Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family. He teaching Imam Ali al-Islam the management of the very first dawat, of the very first invitation of his kins to when he invited them to Islam. And then this indeed helped him to become a better manager, better leader later in the society. But the upbringing in this field was done by the Prophet himself.
Yeah. So over here, one of the qualities which is told by Imam Ali alayhi salam is he who is able to manage his own self truly understands management and will be able to manage others.
Indeed.
So over here,
that's
this
a very
is a beautiful
key point.
Quality. Yeah.
Key point, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So a person should manage oneself. If a person is not able to manage oneself,
mm-hmm,
then there's a doubt over here that can he manage other people or not. And there's another hadith, a beautiful one. Good management acts as a support for one's subjects. And the downfall of leading politicians is due to their poor management. So
right,
the Imam is saying about downfall. When will the downfall happen?
Occur, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, there are a lot of ahadith about
right, yeah,
management.
You also remind me one of the ahadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, wherein he says that everyone who tries to improve his own self will be able to improve the others or the society.
Definitely.
So it's always starts from self. Like we say that charity begins at home.
Exactly. Yeah. So over here, it's very important for us as parents to teach them how to manage oneself in
mm-hmm.
the first place. And yeah, when we speak about managing oneself, they have to see us as well managing
mm-hmm.
ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
If the parents don't manage themselves, then
mm-hmm.
how can they teach their children? Even if
right.
they teach their children, the child will be like, okay, the same is not seen in you.
Yeah.
This is what the counter question will
because
be.
Because they usually learn with actions.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So over here, management on a societal level, because I see parents, I'm so sorry to say, they don't participate in any of the programs. They don't want to actually step into society in the first place. So in this case, and in these scenarios, their children would not like to join in that society, would not like to participate in the programs in that society. Leaving aside, like, management is a big thing. They don't even want to participate in the given programs over there. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
So it's very important that the parent first comes inside the society,
mm-hmm.
okay? At least participation is very important.
Participation is very important. Like,
and
when you are participating, then only your children will participate.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the second thing is, food distribution in
mm-hmm.
mosques, okay?
And
so
what is more with the food distribution? We'll give a pause here to our discussion, and we'll discuss more after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are discussing how do we encourage our children in social participation. Well, you said it began with Imam Ali alayhi salam. If we look back at history, and Prophet himself encourages and teaches him for the first dawah, for the first invitation of Muslims, and then it teaches us a big thing that we can actually count upon a child as young as 11 years old, and this does give them leadership skills, because we as parents do dream of big things, but then we are not, we don't know where to start it from, and we think that then we are confused, why do not the results come overnight? So it starts, like, leadership qualities start as young as 11, like Imam Ali alayhi salam, and yeah, and you said that they learn with actions. Like, if you yourself are not participating in these events, how do you expect them to be a part of such events?
Perfect. And one of the things which is very important when we teach our kids about management is that we are not after perfection. We are not after the program going in the perfect manner.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we have a hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where the Imam says, the peak of good management is the employment of moderation.
All right.
So even in psychology, when we teach about having a good schedule,
mm-hmm.
okay,
excess of everything is bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we don't encourage the person, the opposite person, to fill up the whole schedule.
Yeah.
So there are blocks. Yeah. There mm-hmm. this time blocking system,
mm-hmm.
and once it's done, like the time blocking system is sorted,
mm-hmm.
we tell them, okay, from your morning till evening,
mm-hmm.
write down everything you do, and you have to allot timings for each and every single thing. So this is how the timetable is set.
Mm-hmm.
But we encourage them to keep empty blocks,
yeah.
so that it's not overcrowded.
Yeah.
And once it's overcrowded, then that is when the person
confusion.
Starts to get anxiety.
Yeah.
And if it's not done, then the person gets upset or depressed, and he might even leave the whole schedule.
Yeah.
So keeping empty blocks is actually an act of moderation.
All right.
And of course, in the religion of Islam, we are encouraged a lot towards
about
moderation.
Yeah.
So we are not after complete perfection.
Mm-hmm.
We are after moderation, where the Imam says the peak of good management, it's the peak to
mm-hmm.
have moderation
right.
in the management. So this is just one of the qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And with regards to management, people might say, you know, the thing is, we don't get the opportunity to do management in the Imam Bargah or Husseiniyah
mm-hmm.
or the
mm-hmm.
mosques and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The solution to it is the person or the parent should go
mm-hmm.
to the head of the mosque or the Husseiniyah and should speak to the person in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Let my child involve my child as well.
In the banners, in the background, in cleaning, rather.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's important for other people who got used to it. Like this person ABC who does this work every time, like distributing water, is with this person.
Yeah.
So the person has to be generous by stepping down for a while, for a few days, and allowing and encouraging other people, like other youths, to do this work. This is how they are going to learn. If the people who are normally doing every time, if they sit over there and they do the same stuff every time, then how can other people learn management?
So that's the importance. Thank you, dear listeners. Thank you, Brother Liaquat, for sharing those useful insights with us. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you so much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
When you travel to a historical city, the goal is not just to visit museums and beautiful monuments, but you want to mix with the locals and learn about their traditions and culture. In recent years, many historical houses in Iran have turned to accommodation places, which are called Rumgardi. These are neither hotels nor hostels. They are local traditional houses that provide the opportunity for their guests to meet with locals and live like locals, even for a short time. Nar Titi is the first house we visited, a beautiful place in the small town of Taft, with several traditional elements. An Iranian Zoroastrian couple owns the house. Traveling also means doing activities that we would not have done elsewhere. Each night, all the travelers who stay in this cozy place meet with the owners of the house, drink tea, and eat freshly picked pomegranate from the backyard. And so, they can experience a little different trip and realize that we all share the same fundamental values and same objectives. We're all part of the same planet, and this makes us stay connected.
Staying at these kinds of places adds to one's understanding of the world and understanding of people. It is something which gives you an understanding that all of us are the same. We're all people. We're much more similar than we are different. And when you start taking governments and other things out of the situation, it's just, we can enjoy being with each other and understanding each other and learning about each other.
ingratiating element of the house is a wall full of memories of those who stayed a while in this place. A very interesting wall that takes you to a journey around the world.
Une nuit dans cette maison est particulièrement une expérience particulièrement enrichissante puisque ça permet de partager ces expériences entre les différents voyageurs qui se croisent ici.
In Iran, when a guest or loved one leaves our house, we accompany him or her to the door and throw water to show we want him or her to return very soon. With this compassion, we left that beautiful place to discover other local guest houses. The second place is the House of Baran, which means rain in Farsi, a beautiful adobe house that truly represents the city of Yazd. A very simple house, but artistically decorated and perfectly designed with traditional Persian elements that constantly reminds you of the peaceful spirit of Iranians. A beautiful house with very positive energy. There's a logic behind the location of every piece in decorating this guest house. Some of these elements are symbolic and some others are still functional.
The house has lots of interesting features for me as a visitor. So Abbas, the owner of this guest house, had to adjust the stairs and make them more comfortable for us, people of modern age, to be able to walk down. Because apparently, back in the old days, they were building these stairs very high. The underground room, and there is about 15 to 20 degrees Celsius temperature difference, comparing it to upstairs. So making it a perfect room to chill and maybe take a nap during the hot days of summer. Also, during the cold days of winter, this is going to be a very warm room and area of the building.
Few steps down and tiny little room even gets cooler. Ideal, perfect place to keep your fruits and vegetables during the hot days of summer. Natural cooling system. You know why? Because it's connected to the wind tower room.
There is always a time to say goodbye to even the most beautiful things in this world. What you take from that location or moment is usually what you see or experience towards the end. An unforgettable taste with a beautiful color and very exciting recipe create an experience that I will take with me from Baran Guest House. The exciting thing about all these traditional guest houses is the fact that they're all different in some ways. One is famous for its traditional elements. One is known for its design and decorations. And the other has some very moving stories about the people who lived there, the people who run it now, their families and their relatives. Local people of different regions of Iran, full of love and passion, the most hospitable hosts that I have ever seen in my life. Jahangard Guest House is one of the few places that you can have a unique experience of meeting local elders, hear their stories, and learn about their experiences.
One of the benefits of staying at local guest houses is to have a chance to have this first-hand experience of seeing local handicrafts being made. You see the whole process, and you have a chance to see the craftsman who's behind this precious product, behind making this precious product. And I really enjoy interacting with people, talking to them, and of course learning from them.
One thing is to hear or imagine how life was back in the old days, especially inside these gorgeous traditional guest houses. Another thing is to live the life of those people in those days. It might be some very simple acts, or even sometimes symbolic, but they definitely worth the try. It feels amazing. Shahryar Azimi for Iran.
Thank you.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We'll start off this hour's programs with the Spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. After that, we have The Bridge. The program offers a brief commentary and presentation of the supplications of the noble book, Sahifa Sajadia. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for this hour.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of
the Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As the Israeli regime continues to break its ceasefire agreements in both Gaza and Lebanon, anti-occupation leaders reiterate that resistance is the only way to confront Zionist aggression. What happens when guarantors of the agreements are also part of the problem? Do the Israelis want full-scale wars again? Well, the Secretary General of Hezbollah says surrender is never an option, and the resistance will not disarm. What lies ahead for the region? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Zed Marshall, international law expert and geopolitical analyst out of Geneva. And Batu Sabeti, activist and political analyst out of London. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in London. And Batul, the Israeli regime is currently breaking two ceasefire agreements. I mean, do you think that this is overall part of the regime's strategy to basically agree to the ceasefires in hopes that global attention to its crimes would become less, while at the same time continuing with its killings?
Yes, good evening to you, Marzia, and to your guests and all your viewers. It's not necessary that the policy of the Israeli occupation entity is necessarily matching that of America. At the end of the day, it is America that imposed the ceasefire in both countries, and the Israeli occupation entity, as we know, it wishes to move as it wills, and we see that effectively the ceasefire is not a reality in both Lebanon and in Gaza, in the sense that it's continuously being broken. And actually, the Israeli occupation entity is emboldened in many ways because it knows that right now, in this current phase, the resistance will not per se enter into a direct open war with it, because it's not in its interest to do so, as it is restructuring and recuperating itself in what is now just one pit stop within a much broader and longer battle in this region to ultimately liberate it. So I believe that the Americans support a kind of negotiation under fire. That's their current strategy right now. It is one of closing the direct open wars. Without necessarily having that open war, it wants to achieve what could not be achieved, essentially, within 2 years of direct open war, whether that's in Gaza or, as we know, last year in Lebanon for those 66 days. So the Israeli occupation entity is fulfilling its interests to a minimum extent at a time in which it knows that the resistance won't respond. But ultimately, Israel cannot go outside of the American dictates in causing an all-out war. If it wants to do that, then it has to get the American position ultimately. And we've been seeing a series of escalations since the ceasefire last year on the 27th of November. We saw the peak of the escalation that occurred last month with the assassination of the chief of staff of the resistance in Lebanon. And it must be said that the resistance right now, its lack of response shouldn't be mistaken as its lack of a willingness to respond to the entity. Ultimately, it's preparing for something much greater, and that's for the next war, and that would be like this current war. And I believe, you know, this current phase is about, you know, closing these direct open wars and not opening new ones.
So, Batu, are you saying basically that the ceasefire was forced upon the Israeli regime by the Americans, and right now the Americans have given them a way that they can basically continue their aggression, but having the other side abide by the ceasefire, or what exactly are you saying there?
Right, so what I'm saying is there's a limit to the extent in which Israel transgresses. So America is happy with Israel transgressing as long as there's no reaction from the other side. But ultimately, it is playing with fire here, because what constitutes an aggression so large, such as to start a direct open war? So there's a tipping point. America's ideal is negotiations under fire. It wants to pressure the resistance and get the resistance to a point of disarmament where Israel failed to do so through a direct open war. And that is to turn the government in Lebanon against the resistance. But it's quite hard to do so, or let's say the Lebanese government doesn't exactly have the argument to do so, when Israel's transgressions are so ongoing and continuing. So there's a certain tipping point over here. But what's clear is that Israel, through its direct open wars, both in Gaza and Lebanon, has failed to achieve what its primary goal was, and that's to disarm the resistance and achieve this quote-unquote new Middle East project. So that has clearly failed. America's thinking, what is the next option? Let's assess new strategies, and that's to turn it into an internal front. So in Gaza, it's to get the International Stabilization Force to disarm the resistance in Gaza, to locate the tunnels, to restructure the PA. Essentially, where Israel failed, it's to get the internal fronts to carry out that dirty work.
All right. Well, I'm going to stay with you, Batu. I'm waiting for Sayed Moaz to join us. I mean, when we look at Batu, oh, Sayed Moaz, I have you. Can you hear me? Okay, I think we're still having some audio difficulties. Sayed Moaz, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I saw a nodding of the head, so that was a good sign. Thanks so much for joining us. When we look at the overall situation that is taking place, whether we're talking about in Gaza or we're talking about in Lebanon, we get to the point we have those guarantors of the ceasefires. How complicit, Sayed Moaz, do you see these guarantors? What should they be doing, and what is not happening right now as the Israeli aggression continues in both places?
Well, thank you for having me. Sorry for that technical difficulty earlier. The thing is, you know, these guarantors need to be able to do the basics, and sometimes they're not even able to do that. And that's what brings a lot of these questions into these ceasefires, and why some commentators have, again, called it UCs, and I will continue to fire. And that's how Israel has changed the development around there. I just came from Doha Forum, where this was being discussed, and, you know, there never was a time to discuss about humanitarian aid and access to humanitarian aid as a conversation piece in negotiations. This was supposed to be something that's given anyways. The fact that you have guarantors that are discussing this as a potential negotiating piece clearly shows the one-levelness on this side in favor of Israel. There should be no question as to these basic humanitarian needs. And so what guarantee can we get from people who are negotiating humanitarian access? This is really appalling to begin with, the starting point. And if you even knew the British scholar who actually put the design for this, they're apparently using his playbook. He even came out and condemned America, saying that this is incorrect to use it in this manner. So even the academics and the people in the international community who are working in humanitarian affairs clearly see what these deals are for. They're never in reality for what they're supposed to be, which is ceasefire. They don't have the basics of even that. So the guarantors are one-sided. We do not have parties to this these agreements or these ceasefires that want a serious end to the violence, and to put serious restrictions on Israel, who happens to be the main person in this entire either ceasefire in Gaza or in Lebanon that seems to be violating that. And what are the consequences of that? That's something that the guarantors have to show, the consequences that Israel will get as a result of violating these ceasefires.
Well, let's talk about that. Staying with you, Sayed Moaz, the consequences. I mean, so far, we haven't seen the consequences, but at the same time, people continue to be killed both in Gaza and Lebanon. Let me also add to that the West Bank even. So what are the consequences? And at the end of the day, if there are no consequences, then tell me about what exactly it means to have these type of agreements and the guarantors.
I hate to sound very bleak, but that your question is very a striking one, and that's something that us academics, we're really looking at into now. I mean, for example, this idea of lack of humanitarian access to these locations by the Israeli authorities is essentially genocidal intent. Amnesty International came out last month with a very brazen report suggesting that just because it's a ceasefire, the continued prevention of humanitarian aid access to people in need is a genocidal intent. And that's what it is. Israel is in this Eretz Israel project. They want to take over this entire area. Netanyahu has been blatant about this repeatedly. Smotrich and others who have his allies, they make it very clear that this is what they want. Now, what sort of consequences? I mean, in the Amnesty International report, for example, they're talking about bringing ICC charges, which we know have already happened with Netanyahu and Gallant, but so far no real meaningful action. I mean, just right now, the ICC had a gathering in which they're seeking to support. Some of their judges have been sanctioned. I just met Francesca Albanese. I mean, can you imagine a UN rapporteur who's just reporting the truth has gets sanctioned, and she has difficulty just functioning basics. So there are a few of us who are obviously in the international humanitarian affairs, human rights, but again, countries have to step up, and particularly Muslim countries who seem to have gone toe-in-toe with Mr. Trump. This is great, okay, but you need to be able to push back and get some serious guarantees. And if you cannot get guarantees of basic human rights, basic humanitarian access, the prevention of continued warfare, which Israel continues to do, this is not a ceasefire. This is a continuance of war.
Well, Batul, what does it mean? I mean, as a previous guest said, it's a continuation of war. It sounds good. People are talking about possibilities and of course, that there should be guarantees to allow the humanitarian supplies to enter. But at the same time, as we're speaking, people continually, they're dying. They're being killed. They're being starved to death in Gaza. I mean, the head of Hamas, Khalil al-Hayya, has said that armed resistance and bearing arms remains the right of the Palestinian struggle against the Zionist occupation, obviously stressing that resistance is the only way, and they will not lay down their weapons. I mean, your thought about that comment at this point in time, who was it meant for, and what does it mean exactly in your perspective?
Absolutely. This is the line of resistance, and that is where there is occupation. Resisting is an inherent right. In fact, international law gives that very right, and it's a very natural phenomenon that actually there is a spontaneous reaction to every action. So that is a given right that occurs naturally within the phenomenon of nature's power even, and that's every action leads to a kind of reaction. So when the extent of the permissibility of practicing aggression and committing atrocities, as you've just mentioned, and actually the complete transgression on every human rights occurs, it's very natural to see this kind of resistance, and the legitimacy of that resistance is garnered due to the very action of the enemy. So what if you have every kind of aggression, occupation, and complete transgression combined, you know, so it is not natural for there to be no resistance, you know, based on the extent of the transgression that we're seeing. But you mentioned the superpowers over here and the guarantors. Ultimately, what matters to them in all of this is not securing the rights of the people or their state of being or the allowing of international aid or any of that. What matters to them is for the region ultimately to suit their interests. So right now, they don't want it to turn into an open war. They don't want major instability right now. They let Israel do what it wants right now within that certain limit that we've described, and that is that Israel's targeting of resistance targets in Lebanon should be such that it doesn't go beyond select targets and lead to an open war, because ultimately they want these negotiations to continue whilst under pressure. So it's negotiations under fire. And the guarantors of the ceasefire, US and France, absolutely play no role in safeguarding the rights of the people. In fact, it's the opposite. They allow Israel to do what it wants without opposing. I mean, Tom Barak said this clearly with one word. That is, we cannot and do not wish to pressure Israel. Same words of Lindsey Graham. He went to the extent of saying, even if the resistance in Lebanon is disarmed, we cannot control Israel, i.e. it can do whatever it wants. It can turn even into a Syria model where you negotiate concessions are given, all the concessions of the world. You do exactly what Israel wants, but at the same time, we can target every weapons depot in the country and completely strip away your sovereignty and maintain our very presence and occupy your land, essentially. So that means that there's been zero adherence, the complete opposite of what the US claims. It's backing and justifying everything Israel can do, and we know with the press of a button, it can stop Israel from its actions. Worse than that, what Israel does, its attacks for Lebanon, is being used as a pressure against Lebanon to do what Israel failed to do. So if Israel failed to disarm the resistance, then the Israeli attacks are used to pressure Lebanon to get it to disarm via the government. And we know that the resistance has given its weapons south of the Litani. That's something that the Secretary General has come up and said, and reaffirmed the statements from the UN to that effect. So the guarantors turned things from an all-out war to negotiations under fire. That's essentially what we're seeing right now in the region compared to the status quo before. And that is all because an open war did not reach its goals. And that is because the resistance, may I add, is still strong, AKA it's not been defeated.
All right. Well, Said Maaz, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Qassem, has said that, talking to the Lebanese, that those who are helping the enemy to look